And welcome everyone to a very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and I'm of course joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Doing well. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Very excited.
Super excited.
We've got a very cool guest. We're very lucky to be joined today by veteran production designer and art director Charles William Breen. And wanted to give sort of a background on Charles a bit, and he'll elaborate as well throughout our chat. But he has an extensive list of credits. He's worked with some amazing filmmakers, some of the best in the business. Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, early credit. Worked with Mike Nichols on Postcards from the Edge. Worked on Chaplin for Richard Attenborough. One of my favorite movies of all time, Terminator 2 by James Cameron. He's done work with Clint Eastwood on Bridges of Madison County. He's a two-time collaborator with Neil LaBute on Your Friends and Neighbors and Nurse Betty. And Charles got his start at Universal Studios as a set designer after studying architecture at Cranbrook in Michigan. And over the last 30 years, he has literally amassed one of the most impressive lists of credits, I think, of anybody in his field. And one of his most distinctive credits from a production design standpoint, art direction, was the 2006 gangster musical hybrid Idlewild, which was directed by Brian Barber, with whom Charles has worked many times on music videos as well. It's a visually extravagant movie. It's something that you don't really get a chance to see all the time. And the work there was just wild and eye-popping. And Charles was also Emmy-nominated for a Best Art Direction Emmy for in 1997 for HBO's Weapons of Mass Destruction. And throughout the years, if you take a look at his credits on the IMDb, you'll see that he's applied his amazingly diverse talents to just an incredibly eclectic mix of work. So welcome to the show, Charles. It's an honor to get a chance to chat with you, and we're looking forward to it.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, super, super, super pumped to have you on, man. This is incredible.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So I guess before we get into everything, I wanted to ask you, what's the difference between production design and art direction?
Well, I mean, production design is historically a title dates back to Gone with the Wind. It was an honorary title that was given to the head art director, essentially. And so it's all about art direction, and the production designer has come to be essentially the head of the art department. And so the person who's solely responsible for essentially the look of the film or television project, whatever it is that as the medium is the production designer, I'm usually one of the first people on, and I collaborate essentially very closely with the director, of course, and the cinematographer.
Okay, cool. So you're like so essentially it's like the director of photography, but for the art department.
Yeah, essentially that's true. I mean, I refer to the triumvirate of filmmaking as the the director, the cinematographer, and the production designer. We're usually the first of the creative people on, and we're the people who are essentially responsible for developing the tone, the mood, the look of the film.
Wow. Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool. So looking over your credits is absolutely insane. I mean, it's like I said to you earlier, it's obscene, the films you've worked on. And I mean, what I love about this more than anything is, aside from you working on some of my favorite films of all time and some of the best films, you've gone from like urban legend to Dude, Where's My Car? To working on Blade Runner, to working on Terminator, and almost every genre in between.
Yeah, don't forget the Blues Brothers was one of the first features.
The Blues Brothers, yes, of course.
That was an amazing, amazing film, and one of the first feature films I worked on when I started at Universal. So, and what an amazing film to work on.
Yeah, and not to mention the Concorde, the final airport movie, and High Noon Part 2. So you've essentially worked in every genre.
I think so. I mean, there's nothing that I haven't touched. I mean, I've worked on contemporary projects. I've worked on period films. I've worked on science fiction. I've been a lucky guy, working with a lot of amazingly creative people.
Is there a genre that you tend to gravitate more towards, or something that you enjoy the most, living in?
You know, it depends on the project, of course, but at the same time, I like science fiction a lot. I especially like historic projects that deal with the period aspects of film, and of course, if it's a hybrid film like Idlewild, like the musical that you mentioned, that involves music and dance and a period setting, then that makes it all the more interesting for me.
Awesome. So you mentioned that, so the Blues Brothers, so what is the absolute first, because sometimes it's tough because there's dates that overlap, and you are a multi-hyphenate in the sense that you've worked in various departments and under various, credits. Mm-hmm. What is the first movie that you worked on? What are some of the first experiences you had on your first gig?
Well, the one of the very first feature films I worked on was Airport 79, The Flight of the Conchord, and that was Henry Bumstead was the production designer on that, and it's when I first started working at Universal Studios in the late 70s, and so that was one of my first feature gigs, and then shortly after that, I was asked to go to Chicago and be one of two set designers on the Blues Brothers, where we were for about, I think, 4 months, and did all the location work in Chicago, and then at the same time, we were designing the sets and all the interiors in that movie. Virtually all the interiors were stage sets that we built at Universal Studios.
So Universal put you on a contract and had you work on various features that they were producing?
Well, you know what it was is I was fortunate enough to I caught the tail end of the studio system whereby Universal was the only studio that still had a functioning in-house art department, and so what they did is they hired me initially as a set designer. So yeah, in essence, I was under contract. And started working on television shows when I was, all of like, I think, 22 years old. And then, graduated after a year or so to feature films. And what they would do is they had in-house set designers, art directors, set decorators, and so on and so forth. And they would just assign the in-house people, like the old studio system when people were under contract, to various projects.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was my first couple of years in the business before I went out on my own and started freelancing. But it was a wonderful experience because, when I first started set designing, I was in a giant drafting room with about 50 set designers, and some of them were old timers who had come up through the business and been in the industry forever. And so I sort of cut my teeth with these guys, and they learned, the ins and outs of how to design sets and use stock units and lay things out on stages and all the things that, come with doing a film at a major studio like Universal.
Interesting. So I guess, one of the most incredible credits that you have, and Frank and I are totally obsessed with Blade Runner, considering mm-hmm. that didn't fall under your deal with Universal, how did that come about? How were you scooped up into the Blade Runner world?
Well, it's interesting how it happened, because I did a little known film while I was at Universal called In God We Trust with Marty Feldman. And while I was there and working on this film, I befriended Larry Paul, who was the production designer of the film, and David Snyder, who was the art director. And we all left shortly after that feature film went out on our own. And I got a call one day from David and Larry, and they said, we're doing this science fiction film at the old Columbia Studios in Hollywood, and would you be interested in coming over and working with us on it? And so I said, sure. And so they signed me up. I went over there, and we were in pre-production for a number of months. And I think at the beginning, it wasn't even Harrison Ford who was involved in that film, but Dustin Hoffman was going to play the Deckard role.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was touch and go for a little bit because they lost their financing, and Ridley Scott and Michael Dealey, the producer, had to go shopping around for financing, and all the major studios had turned them down, I believe. And what ended up happening is they flew to Hong Kong, and Sir Runwan Shaw of the Shaw Brothers agreed to finance half of the cost of the film, and they came back with half of the money. And I think Alan Ladd Jr., who was with Warner Brothers at the time, agreed to put up the other half of the money. And we moved over to Warner Brothers and started designing and building the sets for Blade Runner.
Wow.
Well, it's,
yeah.
And what was it like working on when you were physically doing the work? Did you know, or did you think that this was going to become what it became? I mean, I just, you know, what was your gut instinct when you were working on it?
You know, I mean, you always get the feeling that when something is special. I mean, when I was working on Idlewild, I got that feeling. It doesn't happen every time, but Blade Runner was sort of like that. I mean, it was, you know, being driven by Ridley Scott, of course, who was a brilliant guy. Even at that time, he had just come off of Alien, which is one of my favorite, films of that genre, science fiction and outer space. It was just an amazing, time working with him, because he would actually come to my desk and be very specific about what his needs and wants were. I still have some of the sketches that he did, you know, at my desk on any piece of paper, scrap of paper, a piece of a napkin or something. And because my one big set on Blade Runner was Deckard's apartment, which I drew on for like a couple of months. And then we ended up building it on stage at Warner Brothers.
Wow. So you have your own personal Ridley Grams then.
Yeah, exactly. I still have them to this day. And then Sid Mead, who was a brilliant industrial designer, designed a lot of the conceptual stuff in pre-production and was responsible for the designs of some of the vehicles and just the overall look of the modern part of Blade Runner, the cityscape and things like that. And then we built probably most of the street scenes that you see were shot on. We converted the New York street back lot on the Warner Brothers lot was all the street stuff that you see in Blade Runner, and then built a lot of the interior spaces like Deckard's apartment and J.R. Sebastian's apartment on stage. When you saw it going on, I mean, you could tell that. So there was going to be something really special visually. Ridley Scott is a director I've certainly always admired. He really knows how to make a film visually stunning.
Frank and I are
very
huge.
Much so.
And yeah, is it true that there isn't one that all of Blade Runner was shot on sets? That there isn't one like natural like real location, quote unquote? I had read that somewhere. So I had read that somewhere that said 98% of the movie was done on a set, and it's like when you look at some of the shots, you can't put your head around that notion.
Yeah,
so,
no. Every interior was a set that we built on. Say, even J.R. Sebastian's place where he builds his toy. The location was the Bradbury Building in downtown L.A., which is this old historic wrought iron high rise building. And that's where you see the lobby and the lights coming through the skylight and so on and so forth. But then when you go into the interior of that JR's apartment, it's basically a set that we built on stage. The same thing is true of Deckard's apartment. It was based on a Frank Lloyd Wright house in the hills of Los Feliz in Los Angeles, Frank Lloyd Wright house called the Innes House. And what we did is I went there and photographed the hell out of that house, and we took plaster casts of the concrete block and so on and so forth. And then we set about to design, you know, the interior, what could be that exterior in Los Feliz on stage.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Still one of my favorite sets to this day. I mean, it's been running. Blade Runner's been running now for the last month or so on Cinemax, and no matter how many times I watch it and how many times I see it, I always get a kick out of watching that movie.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I'm even looking forward to the sequel, as hesitant as I am.
Yeah,
about it.
But it should be interesting. I mean, especially with Roger Deakins involved as a cinematographer, he's a guy I admire tremendously.
Right. I don't know. It just seems sacrilegious in a way. But I mean, the talent that's revolved around it now thus far that they've announced, I mean, it seems suiting.
Yeah.
So
especially if Ridley Scott is involved and has something to say about it, I'm sure that it's going to be something special. Hopefully.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to
go ahead, Frank.
I was gonna ask you about Gang Related.
Yeah, Gang Related. It was interesting because it was my first feature film as a production designer, and we did it, you know, super low budget. I mean, our budget was maybe $6 million, and it was a brilliant script by a really well-known writer, Jim Kalf, who's directed, you know, several things in his own right. But he did this brilliant script and asked me to production design it. We didn't have a lot of money, you know, and he had this cast of Jim Belushi and Tupac Shakur. And sadly, it was Tupac Shakur's last film, because the summer after we made the film, he was in Las Vegas and was shot and killed. And then they held the film for a good year after his death and didn't release it until then. But it was a really, you know, cool film to work on a lot of different levels.
Yeah, I enjoy that very much since it's released, and over the years I've always really enjoyed watching that film. That's a great film.
Yeah, Jim was a really, really good writer, so he did a good job with the script, and all things considered, I think it holds up fairly well.
It's underrated. It's one of those movies that, you know, I think when it came out, there was just so much hype about, you know, about Tupac Shakur and, mm-hmm. You know, the controversy around his death and everything. And I think that, you know, maybe the attention wasn't paid necessarily to the film. It was maybe paid more to the hype around it.
Yeah,
what an experience that must have been to have been involved in his last project, and then to have the clamor around it to witness that.
Yeah, yeah, no, he was an amazing actor, a really, really, really nice guy, very, very professional, you know, always on the set, always on time, always very courteous, and you know, we had a great time making the film, and I think Dennis Quaid is really underrated in that film.
Oh yeah.
Well, I mean, you don't even really recognize him when he's the homeless guy at first, and I think it has some interesting twists and turns in the story itself.
And to sort of ask just a general question to getting to Frank's initial bit about, you know, art direction versus production design. You start a film, you get hired to work on a movie. You are obviously involved during pre-production, mapping things out, getting things done. When production hits, are you on the set every day? Are you
every day?
It's an everyday thing.
Yeah, it's an everyday thing. It's nonstop, beginning to end. I'm usually the first person on, and then I'm on all the way to the end of principal photography, essentially. And then I may have a little bit of wrap in the end, and there may be some reshoots where they'll bring me back at times. But beginning to end, and it's nonstop, because once, in pre-production, It's all about preparation. It's all about designing, determining what you're going to design and build on stage, and of course all the locations that you have to find before you even start shooting, and then determining what you're going to do to those locations, and then when I first I just went to Vancouver and spent 4 months in Vancouver on a remake of Adventures in Babysitting. And I had never worked up there, and so it's a story of you get on a plane, you go there, and you just start interviewing people and try to put together a good, strong art department, because I'm only as good as the people that surround me. And it starts with the art director, and then the set decorator, the props people, and builds from there depending upon the budget and the amount of work that's going to be done in graphic design, illustration, and set decoration, and all these other things. And then you start putting together the art department, and then you start designing things and building things. And before you know it, whatever pre-production time you had was gone. And then you start filming. And then it just becomes an issue of keeping up with the shooting company and what their needs are, because, of course, as you go along, things change. It could be due to weather, it could be due to production, events. It could be due to an actor being sick and he's not available, and so you have to find other things to shoot. And so it's always a challenge, and it's always. Something I enjoy every single time.
And I just have to ask one question. Did I hear you say that there's a remake of Adventures in Babysitting?
Yeah, that was my last project that I worked on. We shot up in Vancouver I was up there for about 4 months at the beginning of this year, January through April. And it's Disney, because the original one was a Disney film.
It was Touchstone, right?
Yeah, Disney decided that they were going to do a modern take on it, and so we're doing it. It's going to be for the Disney Channel, and it was a lot of fun. We really enjoyed working on it.
Wow, that's very cool. I guess Jonah Hill's The Sitter wasn't a Disney probably wasn't happy with that as a pseudo remake of Adventures of Babysitting. So
apparently not. this one's geared toward a young audience, and instead of one babysitter, there are two of them, and they're competing, and it's kids in the city at night, and so it was a challenge. I mean, to shoot, and when there are kids and animals and all sorts of things involved, I mean, it's always a challenge. But everybody rose to the what needed to be done, and from what I understand, Disney is very happy with the end result, and did it as a television movie, and they're even saying John Schultz directed it, and he's really a feature director, and I've known him for years. He and I have tried to hook up on some other projects that he's done, but they were so Disney was so pleased with the end result that they said it was like we had they gave us this television project to do, and we gave them a feature film back.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, so it was a lot of fun to do.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. How about, man, your credits are awesome. I just can't get over this. Your credits are just incredible.
Thanks.
All right, I want to talk about Phoenix, because I love that film.
Yeah.
And tell me about that, because I love it. I love it so much, how gritty it is.
Well,
and dirty.
Yeah, that's another one of those interesting situations where it was a film that almost didn't get done, because it was I think Lakeshore Entertainment was producing it, and they were at Paramount at the time. And when I was first approached, it was going to be a $6 million project, and Danny Cannon was directing. I interviewed with them. They said, yeah, we want to do it. We want to hire you. And then as it goes sometimes, I mean, I never heard anything more after they talked to me initially. And I went off and did another film somewhere else, and then I came back to town, and my agents called me, and they said, that Phoenix project that you were going to do, they want to do it now. You want to go in and talk to them? I went in and talked to them, and they said, well, we still want to do it, but we don't have $6 million anymore. We have like $3 million. Are you still interested? And I said, sure. And so I met with Danny Cannon again. We hired a DP, and we essentially did it, you know, ultra low budget, non-union, and did it in and around L.A. For Phoenix, Arizona. So that was a challenge. I mean, we shot a lot out in the desert for the you know, the look of Phoenix, Arizona. But it certainly and in and around Long Beach and other cities down in the South Bay and Danny has a real, you know, visual flair, and we made a little money go a long way, and we had a great ensemble cast, you know, guys that have gone on to do really amazing things.
Yeah, that ensemble's amazing. That's that's probably one of my favorite ensembles of character actors, led by Ray Liotta, who I absolutely love. I mean, Tom Noonan, Jeremy Piven, Xander Berkeley. Right. It's great.
Yeah, great cast, and that you know, the script was great, and Danny, you know, being a really visual director. And having a really good James Carter was the DP, you know, just having all the right elements, and it just goes to show you that if you have those key elements in place and a really creative group of people, that you can do a lot with a little.
Yeah. Certainly.
What I have to ask, because another major film that you've worked on, I know Frank and I are big fans, Terminator 2, and getting a chance, what was it like to work with James Cameron on such an absolutely influential film, especially with the emergence of CGI? And, you know, that was truly when people were getting knocked out by stuff they had never seen before. So what was it like to work on that one?
It was a high point in my career, certainly with that genre of film. I had a little bit of history with Jim Cameron, because, you know, one of the first science fiction films I was asked to art direct, it was one of my first art director gigs, in fact, was a Roger Corman film called Battle Beyond the Stars. And, you know, Battle Beyond the Stars was going to be a big budget film for Roger. He was used to doing, you know, six-figure films, and this was going to be like a couple $1 million. And John Sayles did the script for Battle Beyond the Stars. It was a reimagining of Seven Samurai and you know, Magnificent Seven in space. And again, it had a really interesting ensemble cast. And we didn't have a lot of time and a lot of money, and I didn't have a lot of experience at that time. And so what ended up happening is Jim Cameron was working in the miniature model department, and we ended up collaborating on that, and we got co-art director credit on that film. We actually art directed it together, and he went on to do the first Terminator with Gail Ann Hurd, who was Roger Corman's assistant at the time, and the rest is history, as they say. And he went on to do a number of films with Gail Ann, and then when Terminator 2 came up, I was an assistant art director, I think, on that film, and I hadn't seen Jim in years, and we ran into each other in the hallway, and looked at each other like, no. He said to me, "Are you working on this film?" I said, "Yeah, are you working on this film?" And I tell you, it was a difficult film to do, but it was a lot of fun at the same time. We had a good size budget. I mean, at the time it was I think $95 or $100 billion, and that was back in the '90s, and so that had to be some kind of record at the time. You know, I got to go up to San Jose, and I did the Cyberdyne headquarters, the exterior,
and, oh wow,
and the whole thing where they drive the SWAT truck through the lobby, and the elevators and the motorcycle through the offices upstairs, and then the we built the interior of the Cyberdyne facilities on stage out in Valencia. But it was, an epic film to work on. Those scenes in the L.A. River with the truck and the motorcycle, I mean, memorable. memorable.
Very. I mean, I saw that film on the big screen when I was 11 years old, mm-hmm. and not only was I afraid for like a month about nuclear war, I couldn't sleep. Mm-hmm. that movie just completely blew me away, seeing that movie at such an age. And one of the things about it is that, like you said, it's such an epic movie. And even to this day, everything about Terminator 2 feels tangible and real. And like, it was one of these great films that was made before the onslaught of pure CGI.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, just before it became so dominant and CGI was used for everything. It feels like one of those last examples of old school movie making meets the new modern frontier of special effects.
Yeah. Precisely. No, you're exactly right. It has a lot of heart, and the relationship between the Terminator and Sarah Connor and her son and the relationship of her son and the Terminator. I mean, it was just you know, a well scripted film. And then you know, Jim, he's a master at CG and had developed a lot of CG that ended up being used in Terminator on the Abyss. And so, you know, it was a hard film to do, but at the same time, I mean, I think it's one of those films like Blade Runner that held up with time.
Certainly, that film's just insanely great.
Yeah,
I want to watch it right now.
Oh, man. I know, I know. After you going over everything with Cyberdyne, and I might even put it in tonight too.
Yeah,
I don't know. I wanted to put Blade Runner in, and then I wanted to put Phoenix in, and now I want to put Terminator. Maybe I'll just call in sick tomorrow.
Yeah, no, the steel mill stuff that we shot on that was actually shot all in an abandoned steel mill in Fontana, California here. And so we had to go into a steel mill. We had an assistant art director who went down there and lived down there for, you know, like 6 or 8 weeks, just you know, building all the set pieces that needed to be built for the steel mill. And just that sequence in and of itself, and the sequence with the liquid nitrogen truck chase and crash that leads up to, you know, that end fight sequence in the steel mill is epic.
I know, and again, like an epic sequence that was, as far as I can remember, a really clever mix of models, a real truck, you know, like the right. Isn't that, if I'm recalling right, isn't that how they did that sequence? Like,
yeah,
or was it a real truck?
Was actually real, like the thing about the explosions at Cyberdyne, that was a real building we blew up. There weren't any miniatures. It was like a full blown. We took a never been occupied building in San Jose and added a third story onto it and built all the interior, the lobby and the hallways and the elevators, and then on top up on the second floor, built the offices that the motorcycle drives through and that he's shooting down at the cops in the parking lot. I mean, all of that, all the explosions that you see in that was all done live. I mean, some of it may have been augmented.
Unbelievable.
But he didn't want to do any miniatures. He didn't want to do any CG. And a lot of the stunts that you see with the cryogenic liquid nitrogen truck, that was all real as well. There were no miniatures or models or CG involved in that whole sequence.
So you've had a chance to build to then have it blown up.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the kind of scary thing that happened is we blew it up. We blew up that building and then had to go in the next day and shoot the interiors. And because of the explosions, a lot of sprinklers and things went off inside that nobody expected to happen. And so we had quite a cleanup that night before they could go in and shoot the interiors the next day.
Jeez.
It's crazy.
That's amazing. Holy cow,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. But again, it was a fun film. It was hard work, and it took its toll. But at the same time, I think when people put the kind of energy that you put into a film like that, I think that's what makes it special.
Yeah, certainly. That film. I think I'm going to watch that tonight. Now that film is incredible. All right, I want to ask you about Batman and Robin. I know that, like, there's a terrible stigma attached to it, and yeah, it's not that great of a movie, but it's really fun at the same time, and I still enjoy watching it. I mean, I'm a huge Batman fan. Obviously, I love the Nolan films, but the Tim Burton Batman was the first movie I saw in theaters, or remember seeing in theaters.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And I love Returns. I even love Batman Forever, and I even like Batman and Robin just because I love those movies growing up so much. And Batman and Robin's cool.
Yeah, I think Joel Schumacher was directing, and it had Mr. Freeze and another Schwarzenegger role, and we were shooting out in Long Beach at the Spruce Goose Dome is where we built a lot of the sets for that film. Because they didn't have any stages that were big enough to hold some of the sets we were doing. But it was a cool film to work on, no pun intended. But
sounds like something Schwarzenegger should say in the movie.
Speaking of Schwarzenegger, I mean, you have to know that on Terminator 2, that guy had such a sense of humor and was such a fun guy to work with, and he was practical joker extraordinaire. I mean, the guy was and yet he was the sweetest, nicest, most approachable guy. We had, when we were doing that building in San Jose, we took out all the glass of that high rise, building, because we were going to blow it all out. And so we removed every piece of glass and replaced it with our own glass. And we had glass guys that were working there for weeks and weeks and weeks, and one of the guys was a bodybuilder who was working on the glasswork, and he came to me one day and had this bodybuilder's belt, and he said, do you think Arnold would autograph my belt for me? And I said, I don't know, I'll check and see. So I took it to Arnold's assistant. She took me to Arnold's trailer, and he had me come in, and why not? And he takes out a Sharpie and autographs it for the guy. Well, the guy almost passed out when I gave it back to him. I mean, but that's the kind of guy Arnold was. I mean, he was just a really cordial, fun, nice, hardworking guy, very approachable and very very funny. He's a very, very funny man.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And was working on a comic book superhero movie something that you'd want to do? Like, were you a Batman fan?
I loved a very, very good friend of mine designed the original Batman films with Tim Burton, so I was at Warner Brothers when they were doing some of the original, the first Batman films, so when the opportunity presented itself, and I was just on the verge of getting my first production design gig. In fact, I think the Batman and Robin film may have been one of the last things I art directed before I segued into production design. It's always during my career, having the opportunity to work on a wide range and sort of diverse number of films has always been a pleasure, because you never know what's coming up next, and you don't I don't feel like I got pigeonholed and I just did big budget effects driven films. I mean, and now I just finished Adventures in Babysitting, the remake, and so it's always fun to just keep it loose and keep it interesting and keep it creative.
It's awesome. I definitely want to make some time for what I think is one of the most just beautifully designed movies I've ever seen. And in my opinion, it was a travesty that it was not paid. There was not more attention paid to it which is Idlewild. And it's one of those movies that doesn't get made a lot. It's a tricky film. It's got multiple elements, different genres it's touching upon. It was ambitious. For people who don't know it, this was otherwise known as the Outcast movie. It's much more than that. It's just a wild, eclectic mix of the gangster film and romance and drama and music. And I wanted to ask about how you got involved. I know you'd worked with Brian Barber before on music videos. How did the Idlewild project come about, and what are some of your best memories of working on that ridiculously designed movie?
Well, I hadn't worked on any music videos with Brian prior to getting involved in Idlewild. It was after Idlewild that I actually did the music. I did half a dozen music videos with Brian, but Brian was already, when I interviewed on that film, he was like king of the music videos. I mean, he had grown up with Outkast in Atlanta, and so they were close personal friends. And he had this vision of this sort of hybrid film that the only thing I could compare it to that the time that I used as sort of a template for our film was Baz Luhrmann's Moulin Rouge, which I used many times as a reference. And that's where you can see there are distinct sort of similarities in the energy and
oh, yeah.
It's put together, and the fact that it was a period film that used contemporary music, which Baz Luhrmann does in all his musicals, it seems, and he does a great job, doing it. And so, when I went to interview with Brian, I had never really met him before, so I just took a lot of visual reference of period, photographs and some reference books that I threw together quickly, and he liked what I had to say and liked what I had to show him as far as ideas, and so they acted very quickly, and within 2 days I was on a plane to Wilmington, North Carolina, where we built the interior of the huge set that you see, that which is the nightclub, which was called Church in the film, and then proceeded to find all the various locations and assemble the cast, and I had a great a wonderful art department there in Wilmington, and it was we were searching for a director of photography and it was an HBO project at the time. And I remember that they had given us some selections of DPs, but for the director and myself, they just didn't seem right for this project. We needed somebody who had, a real sort of visual sense and flair. And so one of the producers was a sort of a Francophile, and she had a suggestion, why don't we try for a French cinematographer, because they seem to have this real sense of style that was interesting. So I started hunting online for French cinematographers, found this one guy, Pascal Rabot, who shot the film. And the producers flew him over from Paris. He interviewed with the director. The director almost didn't hire him because he couldn't understand him, and because he had a heavy French accent, so it was kind of comical at first. But he eventually acquiesced and said, okay, let's give him a try. And the guy was brilliant. I mean, we had, during the musical numbers, I mean, we had, four cameras going at a time. We had Steadicam, and we had a camera on dolly tracks, and we had a camera on a super technocrane, we had a choreographer by the name of Hinton Battle, who was a Tony Award-winning choreographer who came up from New York City that choreographed a lot of the dance sequence and musical numbers, and the energy that was there was just phenomenal. I mean, he invented a whole dance, a brand new kind of dance a thing that he referred to as SWOP, SWOP, and it was like a combination of swing dancing and hip hop, to make it more modern. And when you watch, the dance sequences in that film, it blows your mind that this guy was able to choreograph such amazing, musical numbers. And we didn't have a lot of time, I mean, we shot the whole thing in like 30 days and
that movie was a month.
I'm sorry?
That movie was filmed in a month.
Basically, I think our schedule was about 30 days. I had about 6 weeks to prepare, and then we shot it in 30 or 35 days.
It's extraordinary. It's one of the most eye-filling movies that I just – there's been a bunch of movies that really have flown, and I kind of feel like 2004, 2005, 2006, there were some really interesting movies that – it always happens every year, these films that fly under the radar and they aren't given enough – credit, and you never really fully understand why. Mm-hmm. But I just the notion that it was a 30-day shoot for such a complicated, intense, production. That's mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. I mean, the even the costumes are amazing in that film.
Oh, yeah.
And the two actors the ensemble cast that they put together for that film.
Yes, great cast. Paula Patton's, one of the most beautiful women in movies, and she just looks like stunning in the film. And
Terrence
Howell is
phenomenal as the bad guy.
Terrific. I love the kid. Yeah, and I don't know the actors' names, but the kid actors, I don't, unfortunately, they're not kids anymore now, but. Hysterical.
Best guys and. We had a great time, and it was one of those, I go out to dinner with the director and the DP and the editor on that film too. I mean, I can't say enough amazing things about the editor. The editor, her name was Anne Goursaud. She was a French woman whose claim to fame is she started with Francis Ford Coppola and did a lot of the films with him when he had a studio in San Francisco and was with him from the time she got out of school, and she's a brilliant editor. I think she's even directed a couple of things in her own right, but I don't think that film would have been the film that it was without her brilliant cutting. I mean, she was just a phenomenal editor.
Yeah, the opening credits, how it's cut to the beat and everything is just beautiful. And it's so awesome that there was such a French influence on that film. It's like you wouldn't necessarily think for some reason.
Yeah. To have a French cinematographer and a French editor and a young black director. And he and I went on to do half a dozen amazing music videos after that. I did this Christina Aguilera music video with him called Ain't No Other Man. That is it was based on Christina Aguilera saw out the Idlewild movie and that we did with Outkast and she wanted a music video that was like a 40s musical and so we did Ain't No Other Man based on Idlewild, essentially. It had a similar kind of look.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, let's move to The Hunt for Red October.
Oh,
love it.
Yeah.
One of my all-time favorites. Amazing cast.
Yeah, not only that, but, we built both of those submarines, both the American submarine and the Russian submarine were sets that we built on stage at Paramount. And we both built both of the sets on a gimbal, and so they could tilt in any direction. The gimbal was like 50 feet square, and everything inside was practical. All the lights, it was built from both of the submarines were designed and built from scratch essentially.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can't believe that.
John McTiernan and Jan DeBont was the cinematographer, and Terry Marsh was the production designer who had worked with David Lean on movies like Dr. Zhivago and Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, Jesus.
I mean, that's the other amazing thing about my career is when I was coming up as a set designer and assistant art director and eventually art director is I got to work with some of the most amazing people, production designers like Dean Tavalaris was one of my mentors, and Dean Tavalaris won an Academy Award for The Godfather. He did Apocalypse Now. He did a lot of Francis Ford Coppola's early movies. And then I got to work with Ken Adam, who did the early James Bond movies, worked with Stanley Kubrick on Barry Lyndon and Dr. Strangelove. And, when I worked with him, he was probably in his 70s then. And, he's a multi Academy Award winning production designer. Terry Marsh was an amazing production designer to work with. I worked with a production designer by the name of Patricia von Brandenstein on a couple of things. And she won an Academy Award for Amadeus.
Incredible talent right there.
I've had this amazing career, but I've also lived this charmed life of having, people like that who mentored me, where I got to not only work with, the best, but learn from the best. And when I was finally ready after years of being a set designer, assistant art director, and art director, when I was finally ready to be a production designer, I had, amassed a great deal of wealth and knowledge from working with these people, and knew, what needed to be done to get the kind of, look that, and it's, like I tell people in interviews, I mean, it's not always a function of budget or of money. A lot of times it is if you want to build a lot of things, but like on Adventures in Babysitting, I mean, we got this great feature look and we built very little on that film. It was all about finding, amazing locations and just making it look as good as you possibly can.
It's like, where do you go from there? We got to ask about Clint Eastwood. What was it like working with him on Bridges of Madison County? Because obviously one of the greatest American filmmakers of all time, and it's yet another legend that you've had a chance to work with.
Yeah, talk about another legend. I mean, working with like some of the directors that I've had a chance to work with, but getting to go to Des Moines, Iowa, and I think I spent 4 or 5 months out there working on Bridges of Madison County with Clint Eastwood and Meryl Streep, and it was another one of those films where there was so much chemistry between the two of them as actors that it's what made it come off the screen and made it a totally believable film and such a beautiful. I mean, we were going to build the interior of that farmhouse on stage and Bruce Beresford was originally going to direct it, and then Clint Eastwood took over and he was insistent upon building the set at the real farmhouse exterior, because we found the farmhouse exterior, but it was basically just a shell. So then what we had to do is set about building a whole interior in that abandoned farmhouse out in the middle of a cornfield. So everything that you see in that film, all the interior part of the farmhouse was constructed for the movie. I tell you, it was just a magical sort of experience working with those two.
And what's it like to watch Clint in action when he's directing? How is it? Because I've heard all these different stories, and everybody always talks about him, and he's got such a unique style. Is he as fast moving as you hear, and as unfussy as you hear?
Yes, exactly. I mean, those are two really good words to describe him, because he shows up totally prepared. He doesn't abuse his crew at all. I mean, he starts working right away, and usually works short days. Works very closely with the cinematographer, and I tell you, I mean, I learned so much just watching his style of directing, because he's so, matter of fact, and I attribute a lot of that to the fact that he was an actor for years And so a lot of that comes from his years of experience as an actor, and you look at his body of work as a director, and I mean the guy is like Woody Allen, where he just, it seems these days he's doing a film every year, every other year, and he just continues to crank out the stuff.
That's incredible.
Yeah, really, really nice man too. Very approachable, and loves music, loves working closely with his crew, and just a terrific person.
Wow, I wanted to ask you about Dave. Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite Kevin Kline roles.
So funny.
Yeah. It was hilarious to work on my friend who's since passed away. Michael Riva was the production designer on it, and I had worked previously with Ivan Reitman a couple of times when I was art directing on Beethoven and Beethoven Second. And so when my friend Michael Riva was doing Dave, he asked me if I'd come and be one of the art directors, and it was a fun movie to work on, and Ivan Reitman's a great guy to work with. He's a very demanding director, but we built a lot of wonderful sets, and Kevin Kline was terrific.
That's great. Yeah. You know what? And I noticed that you've worked with Charles Grodin on films, or I should say worked on films that Charles Grodin worked on as well multiple times in your career.
Yeah, Beethoven and Taking Care of Business and Beethoven
right.
Second. He's a funny man. Funny man.
Got to ask you what it was like to work on Sneakers, because that for me is one of the...
Yeah, Sneakers is great.
It's such an underrated movie, and you know, you never hear from someone who's seen that movie, I didn't like that movie, that wasn't a good movie. Like, everyone likes Sneakers. And what was it like to work with Phil Alden Robinson, who I wish was more prolific? I wish he had five or six more credits to his name, because he's such an intelligent, classy filmmaker. Yeah. Not to mention getting a chance to work with Redford.
He was a really, I mean, Phil Alden Robinson, I mean, he's a brilliant writer, and he was a pleasure to work with as a director. And that's one of the films that I worked with on with Patricia von Brandenstein as well. So she was the production designer on that film. And it was just a lovely working experience and a fun film to work on. Again, an amazing ensemble cast with Robert Redford and all the rest of the guys.
Jade, yeah. Directed by William Friedkin.
Yeah, that was an experience. That guy,
Esther House script. That's a crazy movie.
Yeah, it was.
That's a 90s move.
Yeah, and it was. A fairly good sized budget. I think that we had $50 million. We shot up in San Francisco for about 4 or 5 months. And then we built sets at Paramount Studios and at the Raleigh Studios and at Sony as well. So we built interior sets at three major studios down in LA after we shot in San Francisco for about 4 months. That crazy chase scene through the streets of San Francisco and through Chinatown during a Chinese New Year's parade. I mean, we shot that for 5 days, but you could only shoot during certain hours, limited hours on a 5 day schedule, and it was a huge production because I mean they had 5,000 extras and we had a whole Chinese New Year parade with floats and everything that we staged. That was all. Us, we didn't just go on the day they were having a Chinese New Year's parade. I mean, we actually literally, staged our own Chinese New Year parade and then drove cars and had a car chase through it. That car chase rivals Bullet in some respects.
It's sick. The car flip in that movie, say what you want about Jade, whatever, fine. It's sleazy. It's whatever. It's overheated, fine. The car flip in that movie
yeah.
is I don't care. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, it's one of the best car flips that was ever done for any flick. And leave it to William Friedkin, of course, to constantly try to top himself with car chases and, you know, real time.
Exactly. And we keep in touch to this day, and he's one of those directors that has the reputation of being a really, really difficult guy to work with, and he can be, but at the same time, if he likes you and likes your work, I mean, he really appreciated everything we did for him on that film, and I enjoyed working with him. I mean, but he is a really, really, he's like, you know, Jim Cameron in a lot of respects, a very demanding sort of guy.
Wow.
Yeah. But awesome. Yeah, but it was it's one of those films I throw in every once in a while, and it holds up. I mean, it's got its sort of Joe Esterhaus quirkiness to it, and the ending is kind of weird, but I thought his of casting, you know, David Caruso was good, and I thought Chaz Palminteri is great. I admire his work.
Yeah, I love Richard Crenna.
Yeah, and Richard Crenna was governor. Yeah.
And Linda Fiorentino, when she was in her pure femme fatale, you know, coming off The Last Seduction, and, you know, she was like the go-to woman for that sort of role. So, we definitely, it was mentioned here and there, but we got to ask, just because they were so popular for so many kids, and we grew up with them and everything, and it's some of the best animal work you've probably ever seen in a movie. What was it like to work on Beethoven and getting a chance to like be near those dogs and, you know, having them no doubt rip up the set that you so carefully designed?
Well, it was both of the films I worked on. I worked on the first one and worked on the sequel, Ivan Reitman was involved. He was producing when he had his production deal at Universal at the time, and we had a fairly good sized budget, and we built the sets on stage for the Newton House. We shot in South Pasadena, and then we built a whole backyard of the Newton neighborhood up on the top of the back lot of Universal. And so it was, from a design standpoint, it was a fun movie to work on. But, we shot for 60 days. And because of the length of shooting, and you had to deal with the fact that there were puppies and the puppies got big right away, I think we had a number of sets of dogs that they kept trying to match, and so it was always a challenge. Anytime
there
and small kids, it's always makes it interesting. That's for sure.
Okay, before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you about High Noon Part 2, The Return of Will Kane.
Yeah, television movie.
Lee Majors, David Carradine. Yeah,
David Carradine.
Awesome.
We shot it in, I think in Tucson, Arizona, and in Tucson there was this town on the outside of Tucson, out in the desert, called Old Tucson. That was an old Western town, and so we shot a lot of the film in this old Western town. And I think there was a portion of that Western town where the original High Noon was filmed as well. This art director friend of mine got the gig and called me up one day, and he said, how would you like to go to Tucson and do a Western with Lee Majors and David Carradine? And it was a fun project to do. A lot of the stuff was there, left over from the old Western. So it was just a question of finding stuff that was still standing and rebuilding a lot of stuff in the old town.
Yeah, I don't know how anybody can find this, but I hope people try and seek this out, because I really enjoyed it. I saw it on VHS. I think my dad had it. I don't know if my dad still has it. I should steal it from him if he does.
Yeah, I mean,
Elmore Leonard wrote it. It's got a great cast: Lee Majors, David Carradine, M. Emmett Walsh, Tracy Walter. It's a good movie.
Yeah, I think it's one of those sort of hidden gems that unless you know about it, I mean, it's
right
out there, and I haven't even seen it on television, to be honest with you, but I wouldn't mind taking another look at it myself.
So what does the immediate or what does the future hold for your work? What's coming up on tap for this year and next? I mean, we know you talked about further adventures in babysitting, but tell us about maybe a little bit about Bolden or something that's coming up.
Well, I don't know. Bolden, they just did another series of reshoots, and I still keep in touch with the director, Dan Pritzker, who did it. And it may be, you know, I mean, it's been at least 6 years or more since I worked on the first iteration of that film. So I don't know how much longer, you know, they're going to be in post-production on that, especially considering they just shot for another 18 months on it. And you know, that might be coming out eventually. I've been working on some television recently. I've spent the last 3 years working on a television series or a couple of television series in Chicago. I did a television series for MTV called Underemployed that was kind of fun. And then I did a series for Dennis Leary called Sirens about EMTs in Chicago. You know, there's a lot of work in television in various parts of the country, and I'm also seeking out you know, my next feature film project as well, and I'm not sure what that is, but I'll keep you posted.
Yeah, certainly do. That would be great.
Yeah.
And real quick, High Noon Part 2 is part of a double feature with the Alamo, some Alamo movie with Alec Baldwin, and it's on DVD on Amazon for $8.
Awesome. Awesome.
I'll link it to you. I just linked it to Nick, and I'll post it on our Facebook page. Hopefully people check it out, because it's really good. I just bought it.
Yeah.
I can't wait to revisit it.
Cool.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. This has been an incredible chat, man. This has been phenomenal.
Thank you.
Yeah, Charles, I hope it wasn't too rapid fire for you, because honestly, it's overwhelming to have all these titles to throw at your way and to hear these stories. It's unbelievable. So I know that, you know, given that Frank and I are such big fans of movies, it's like, you know, like a kid, you know, in a candy store picking, you know, which one to ask you about. So it's very exciting.
I'm excited and glad to have joined you, and it was a lot of fun, and you know, like I said, I've been a lucky guy with my career and working with the people that I've had the pleasure of working with.
Yeah, awesome. Man, that's fantastic. That's awesome.
Yeah, and thank you again for coming on. We'll definitely be keeping in touch with you for sure. When you know the new projects hit up, we'll, you know, get going. We'll get you back on. We'll talk about things in the future.
Sounds great. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you, man. Anytime, more than welcome to come back.
Okay, take care.
See ya.
Thanks.
Bye.